Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the Hamas victory in the West Bank and talk about its consequences with Dr. Bashara Dumani, who is a professor in the Department of History at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of Rediscovering Palestine. He is working on a new book, The Social History of the Palestinians, and he had an op-ed published in Friday in the Los Angeles Times titled Hamas in Charge. We'll also go to the West Bank and speak with Dr. Mamdou Aika, who's a physician. He's the Commissioner General for the Palestinian Independent Commission for Protection of Citizens' Rights. And, of course, we'll look into the extent to which the rejectionist wings of Fatah are roaming the street firing guns and what kind of stability there is there. We'll also talk with Christopher Pyle, who's a professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College. He was an Army intelligence officer who, during the Vietnam War, blew the whistle on domestic spying, and he became one of the people that testified, worked for Sam Ervin, who helped. He was one of the people who testified to help draft the very FISA law that President Bush has circumvented in unleashing the NSA's assets on the American people. And we're talking to him about not just that burgeoning scandal, but also the Pentagon's secret Talon program and other domestic spying. And then we'll talk with the filmmaker of a new film, Why We Fight. Eugene Jaracki will be joining us here in the studio. He made this film about the military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower first warned us of in his farewell address. And this film looks into the extent that the military-industrial complex has a lock both on the American treasury and on the American culture. So let us now begin with the victory of Hamas in Palestine and its consequences. I'm speaking with Dr. Bashara Dumani, and we'll also hear later from a physician, Dr. Mamdou Aika, who was in the West Bank. So obviously, frankly, I wasn't so surprised by this Hamas victory. In fact, I talked about it earlier with a former member of the Israeli Knesset a couple of weeks ago, because it seems to me pretty logical that people vote for governments that take care of their interests, and that the Palestinian Authority wasn't taking care of very much except themselves, the Hamas, for the longest time, have been providing services, food for the poor, and health care. So were you surprised, Dr. Dumani?
No, I wasn't surprised that Hamas did very well, but I think most people were surprised the extent to which they did win in terms of the number of the seats. And I think that has to do with the way that the elections were structured, with a district list and a national list. If you look at Hamas's share in the national list, somewhere around 45%, but you look at the district list, which is the other half of the parliament, then they got, with the independents that they supported, about 50 out of 66.
Now, of course, one of the reasons for that is that they are a very disciplined party, and that the Fatah people, the various factions, ran against each other in all these districts.
That's right. There was an implosion in Fatah itself. They first split up into two lists, then they cobbled them back together again, and they ran a really very weak list. And on top of that, on the district level, many people who are Fatah people ran as independents. And so the vote leaked like a sieve from the Fatah lists, but it really was like a laser beam, very focused in terms of the Hamas list. This tells us that Hamas not only is very rooted in civil society type organizations, which accounts for its sort of long-term, hardcore popular strength among at least 30-40% of the Palestinian population, but also that they invested enormous energy in running a very tight and disciplined on-message election campaign that they started preparing for long before Fatah did. In fact, they held their own internal primaries without anybody hardly noticing that they had primaries, whereas the Fatah primaries were were really a big debacle.
Let me bring in Dr. Mamdou Eka, who is a physician. He's Commissioner General for the Palestinian Independent Commission for Protection of Citizens' Rights. Why did the independents not do as well as both Hamas and Fatah?
To my mind, the main cause for the factions as well is that they were not unified. Actually, there was an effort, I was involved in it personally, to unify what we call the third way. All those who are disenchanted with the polarization of the Palestinian political society into two poles, who was in the controlling the authority, the Palestinian National Authority, and on the other hand, there is the rising of Hamas and the Islamic movement at large. There has been an effort to form a new movement for the last few years, and especially after in preparation for the election, the Legislative Council election. But unfortunately, for many reasons, and basically, this individualist attitude, it did not lead to have one unified list for encompass all these personalities and factions. So the vote was scattered.
Well, you know, you get the feeling that most of the independents are the most talented people, they're certainly the ones that we're used to seeing on television, like Hana Nashwari. She did, and Dr. Barghouti. They both, I believe, were elected. But combined, if you combine the independents, say with Fatah, Hamas still has a majority, does it not?
Yes. Now, mentioning Barghouti and Hana Nashwari and Dr. Salam Fayyad in one list. And maybe 6 weeks before the elections, it didn't work, and they went into two lists. And there was a third list as well in Gaza, Dr. Iyad Sarraj. Again, he was supposed to be on the same list. But they were fragmented into three lists, let alone the other PLO factions. Now, I would add to what Dr. Domani said, that this dimension should not be forgotten, that movement at large in the whole region is on the rise. And I, for one, won't hesitate to say that.
Well, I'm afraid the phone, for some reason or other, there's a period where it just drops out altogether, and it's very, very mysterious. So let me go back to Dr. Bashar Dumani. What was the point that Dr. Eka was agreeing with you on?
He may have been agreeing that there's a sort of ascendance throughout the entire region of Islamist political culture.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he won't hesitate to say something, and I didn't hear it either. I would be very interested in knowing.
Yes, actually, I was going to say,
please.
Okay. If elections would happen now in any Arab country in the region, I have no hesitation to say that the Islamists will win that elections. Look what happened in Egypt. In spite of all the pressure and in spite of all the restrictions on the Islamic movement, they achieved a good chunk in the Egyptian parliament.
And we've also got the example of Iraq as well.
And Iraq as well, yes, right. Yes.
So what does this say to you, though, that does this mean, as far as the Islamists are concerned, they like democracy, one man, one vote, but only one time? That, in effect, what's happening here is that democracy is turning into theocracy with one election?
No, this may not be the case. Talking to many of Islamists, especially in Hamas, before and after they won the elections here in Palestine, give all the assurances that they will commit themselves to democracy and that this game will not be just for once. So we have to wait and see and how they will practice the democracy at work during the term in the parliament.
Let me bring back Dr. Bashara Dumani. Do you see this as a different situation from what happened in Algeria with the feast, the Islamic Salvation Front, when, of course, the government cancelled the elections when it looked like they would win? And, of course, we can't say for sure that the feast would have suspended democracy, but that was obviously the fear on the part of the military government.
It's very important to recognize that a lot of these Islamic movements are homegrown movements with very different agendas, very different contexts, and very different goals from each other. We cannot compare what's happening in Palestine with Egypt, with Iraq, with Algeria, with elsewhere, except on the level that there is a certain language, a political language, that's become a common language, but it's being used to very different ends. So in the case of Palestine, for example, we should also bring in Turkey, because you had an Islamist sort of movement win elections there. In the case of Palestine, I think it's very important to recognize that the democratic experiment that's been going on, the Palestinians have shown themselves to be unbelievably committed, even under occupation, the very difficult conditions of lacking freedom of movement, etc., to hold elections and that by anybody's standard and criteria were full, fair, and honest, with close to 80% participation. And I think Hamas knows this very well, as do the others, and I don't doubt at all that Fatah, for example, now will be eager to hold the elections in 4 years, whereas before, when they had control, they were not very eager to hold elections, and 10 years passed before they allowed, it wasn't just up to them, but before they really consented and pushed for elections again between 1990 and 2000.
That's very true.
Well, let me ask you, Dr. Mamdou Akir, in the West Bank. It seems that, I mean, President Bush's statements afterwards were interesting and somewhat conflicted. While he mentioned that the United States wouldn't deal with a terrorist organization and nor would Israel, he also said he was not surprised, in a sense, that people voted for government services, implying that the Palestinian Authority, Fatah, didn't deliver, and Hamas did deliver. In fact, he sounded like a liberal Democrat. He was saying, you know, people want health care and secure pensions and security on the street. And explain to me how it is that Hamas can deliver social services, which they apparently have been doing for some time, and the Palestinian Authority can't. Who is funding Hamas?
Actually, Hamas is funded partly locally and partly because you have to remember that this is an Islamic movement that have connections in the region and I would say even in many parts in the world. They have donations. And in Islam, there is this system of taxation, the zakah. Mm-hmm. So they created a network of social services and clinics. As a physician, clinics they have established, and also schools, kindergartens, which have been working since, I would say, the first intifada in 1988. They are targeting the needy people. When you compare it with the services delivered by the national authority, especially by Fatah, it is a government system, and they have all the illnesses and defects of any government system. Added to this, that the level of corruption is too much.
Let me bring back Dr. Bashara Dumani, since we still seem to be having problems with the connection to the Palestinian territories. Tell me why it is that, and we know that the funding from the Europeans and from the United States is somewhat in jeopardy now that Hamas has won and people aren't quite sure what to do about. But given that the Palestinian Authority, the Fatah, was had access to funds, and of course a lot of the funds go through Israel in terms of customs duties and stuff, and they have more than veto power. But the long and the short of it is, how do we get to this situation where Hamas could be funded by outside Islamic sources and Fatah was squandering the money? I mean, wasn't somebody noticing this?
Well, Fatah, remember, was in charge of institutions of a state, though this state lacked any kind of sovereignty or power. So they had tremendous responsibilities for, like, paying the salaries of all the teachers or all the physicians on the government payroll, etc. Over 150,000 employees that they were responsible for getting the money for. And donor states gave more than half of the money that they needed for that. It would be a huge mistake if the Palestinian people are going to be punished by European Union or the United States for electing for their political democratic choice of electing Hamas by having all these donor funds stop from reaching the Palestinian Authority and, of course, Israel from Israel as well. So Hamas is going to be in a situation right now where they have to deal with a big mess left from the Fatah-controlled PA from before, which was basically going broke about a month or two ago. Salaries have not been paid, etc. So on top of that, to have European Union, for example, stop funding sewer infrastructural or building, helping to build a college, as they did in Nablus, for example, for Al-Najah University, simply because a person who was supported by Hamas won the municipal elections and became mayor, would be a big mistake. That person that was elected was seen by everybody in Nablus as being very clean, who was not an ideologue but a long-term civil servant. And they liked him much better than any candidate had, that Fatah could offer. And they elected him, but now they're losing the possibility of, rebuilding their university or doing other infrastructural projects in Nablus because they depend on outside donors. This is a very serious situation, and it's something that we'll wait to see how it develops over the next few weeks.
But just in general, in closing, it puzzles me as to why 40 years have gone by and it's as though nobody's seen the writing on the wall here. I mean, the United States has been in the occupation business in Iraq for a couple of years now, and we know what a disaster that has been because, essentially, they're not delivering social services, and most of all, they're not delivering security to the people, and that's why this insurgency is growing. So it seems to me so extraordinary that the Israeli occupiers who have had all the power haven't really encouraged a civil society or have allowed or this corruption to flourish. It seems so counterintuitive. And, of course, in your article, you suggest that perhaps, you know, that's the attitude that they have. Well, you know, we have no partner in peace. You know, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. But could you, either of you gentlemen, address that?
Yes, actually, I would like to add, vis-a-vis the Israeli example, is that with their short-sighted, they have this security, over-exaggerated concern about security, is that they resort to collective punishment with this system of restriction of movement, and if anything happens, they will punish the whole city or town or the neighborhood where something happens. This led to frustration after frustration after frustration, and eventually people will...
Yeah, I'm afraid our phone thing is dropping out again. Let me just close with you then, Dr. Damani.
Sorry for this.
Yeah, it is. It's unfortunate. Just in closing, Dr. Damani, do you think we'll be seeing signs of the traditionally secular Palestinian state being under the kind of Islamic strictures of dress codes, no alcohol? Is that going to start happening?
Hamas leaders have made it very clear after the elections that they don't intend to make any sudden moves, either on the social level, which is a level that they've always been concerned with when it comes to educational content of books, when it comes to public dress, when it comes to all sorts of personal status laws, etc. They've made clear statements that they're not going to move suddenly on any of these fronts, though only time will tell what will happen a year or two from now. They've made this similar sort of restrained and very calculated and very programmatic response to other issues such as the relationship to other factions, to Israel and to the world community. So they basically are saying that they're going to take very sort of responsible, calculated moves based on a kind of a carrot and stick policy. If the world community and the Palestinian factions are willing to work with Hamas, and Hamas is willing to readjust its stand on several issues in order to make that possible, they're extending their hand, and only time will tell whether anybody is going to shake it or not.
I thank you both, gentlemen, for joining us here in Los Angeles. Dr. Bashir Damani, thank you, who's an associate professor of history at the UC Berkeley and the author of Rediscovering Palestine, and Dr. Mamdouh Aika, who's a physician and the Commissioner General for the Palestinian Independent Commission for Protection of Citizens' Rights in Palestine. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Christopher Pyle, who's a professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College, who's written extensively on freedom of expression, equal protection of laws, rights of privacy, and he's also been an investigative journalist who has won the Polk and Hillman Awards for investigative journalism. He's written a book, The President, Congress, and the Constitution and Military Surveillance of Civilian Politics, and he has a forthcoming book, The Art of Civil Discourse and Its Relationship to Responsible Citizenship. And Dr. Pyle, of course, you were in Army intelligence during the Vietnam War, and you broke rank and blew the whistle on the illegal activities of the United States Army intelligence spying on American citizens during the Vietnam War, and then you went on to join the committee headed by Senator Sam Ervin, the Senate Judiciary Committee, looking into the excesses. And this was at the time of post Watergate, you were also involved in the very beginning and the genesis of the FISA laws themselves. Didn't you testify?
I actually testified against FISA.
You testified against FISA.
FISA was a compromise because there were judges who were willing to grant rather sweeping power to the executive. And there were other judges who were adamantly opposed to that. The legal community was strongly split. And the Supreme Court was getting more conservative, and so Congress negotiated a compromise bill that would occupy the field and would make it relatively easy for NSA and the FBI to get wiretaps. All they'd have to prove is probable cause to believe that the target of the surveillance was an agent of a foreign power, and let the Attorney General certify he needed the information, but he wouldn't have to show any evidence of any criminal activity. And that was a compromise statute, as often happens in politics. We preserved at least part of the Fourth Amendment, but we also allowed extensive surveillance, which would not be permitted in a criminal context. But the assumption was that we'd never prosecute these agents of foreign powers anyway. If we caught one, we'd swap him for one of our agents abroad. We were not thinking in terms of law enforcement.
Well, that, of course, we have a different dynamic today as opposed to the Cold War tit-for-tat dynamic.
We want to prosecute people.
Well, we have subnational and transnational threats that are quite different,
people
who don't represent states. So tell me, though, I mean, how do you feel then if you were a whistleblower from Army intelligence, you testified, and you thought FISA, you testified against FISA. Here we have the President of the United States who is ignoring FISA and unleashing the NSA on American citizens in secret.
Well, that is a crime. The FISA statute said that its procedures would be the exclusive procedures by which national security monitoring would occur, and that anybody who violated that law would be guilty of a felony punishable by up to 5 years in prison. The President of the United States quite clearly has committed a felony. Now, his defense is that essentially he's above the law. Either Congress allowed him to be above the law when it allowed him to go to into conflict against the people who bombed the United States on September 11, or, even more sweepingly, that he has an inherent constitutional power in time of war to ignore criminal laws. Criminal laws, in this case, written to restrain him and his agencies. Now, that's an extraordinary claim, probably unprecedented in American history, although Richard Nixon came close. And if it were to be acquiesced in, we would create an historical precedent that presidents in the future would claim of both parties, and that would be a very dangerous road, because essentially it says we don't have three branches of government. When we go to war, we have only one branch of government, and it can, in secret, commit crimes.
Well, the president argues we are at war. That was his, when he went over to the NSA this week, the National Security Agency, which is used to be jokingly referred to as no such agency because it was so secret. He went there, he went into the operations center, and he said to the cameras that, you know, we're at war, and we got to take bin Laden's latest threat seriously. So this is ultimately what he's going on the offensive with, is he's trying to sell the idea that this country's at war.
Well, he hopes that if he repeats his protestations many, many times, that the public will come to believe them. But the fact is, the public can look up the law. It's Section 2511, 2F, of Title 18 of the U.S. Code. You can easily get it on your computer. It says that the FISA statute and the FISA court are the only procedure he can use. He's violated that. He did it in secret. He also committed fraud upon the FISA court because they kept applying for warrants with the FISA court when they had probable cause to believe that the target was an agent of a foreign power, including a terrorist group. But when they didn't have that much evidence, when they only had a suspicion, they simply tapped anyway, ignoring the court.
Well, obviously, this is a cynical approach on their part, because if they had ignored FISA altogether, FISA would have noticed that there aren't any cases going through.
The judges would have been very curious. You're right. Yeah. Absolutely right.
Well, I don't understand the culture of people like General Hayden, who used to be the head of the National Security Agency, is now the number two in this new layer of intelligence, essentially a political layer. Headed by Negroponte, the director of national intelligence, and General Hayden being the deputy director, when he had that press conference this week to explain what they're happening, to justify what the president's been doing, you got the impression that General Hayden simply doesn't understand the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, it was toward the end of the press conference, and he was asked by a reporter from Knight Ridder. But don't you need probable cause? Doesn't the Fourth Amendment require that you obtain probable cause before you conduct this kind of probable cause and show it to a judge before you conduct this kind of eavesdropping? And the general said, no, all we need to do is to have a reasonable investigation. An investigation reasonable to whom? To the secret spies inside NSA, not to a judge. No showing outside of a judge. Well, everybody knows that the Fourth Amendment has two clauses. The first one is the right of the people to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures. The second one is that warrants shall only issue upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, etc. And he claimed to have been talking to a large number of lawyers, and he claimed that NSA understood the Fourth Amendment very, very well. He claimed they understood the FISA statute very well. But both the FISA statute and the Fourth Amendment clearly state the standard for determining the surveillance, its legitimacy, is probable cause. And it's probable cause determined by a judge, not probable cause determined by a night supervisor in Fort Meade, Maryland.
Yeah, that was his explanation, that the shift supervisor was the one that essentially had made the decisions, not the judge, which is extraordinary in itself. Well, tell me about what's going on, though, with for you, it's deja vu over again. Now we find out that the Pentagon is spying on American citizens, peace groups down in Florida, for example. I mean, perfectly harmless people trying to exercise their First Amendment rights to petition the government.
Well, that's what I disclosed back in 1970. Back in 1970, Army intelligence had 1,500 agents working out of 300 offices coast to coast, monitoring every demonstration of 20 people or more. And that information on lawful political activity was going into record centers in at least four different command bases and in numerous military intelligence groups, and was being shared with the FBI and police and many others.
And it wasn't being gathered professionally. It's probably a bunch of conscripts, right? Yeah, getting hysterical over anything.
Actually, the guys who collected it had a sense of humor. They were about the same age as the demonstrators.
Uh-huh.
Many of them were related to the demonstrators by birth. But their job was to file reports. And so, some were volunteers. Many Army my guys were volunteers. But in any case, that was their job. They were told to do it, and they did what they were told. But the result was they had created the apparatus of a police state. The apparatus of a police state is the capacity to collect massive amounts of information on political dissenters. And that's what they did. And so we disclosed that. We investigated it. We persuaded 125 agents to tell what they knew about it to Congress, the courts, and the press. And the system folded, even though President Nixon wanted to keep it going.
Well, but the thing that's extraordinary about this, though, Christopher Pyle, is that this all happened before computers.
And it happened before Watergate.
Right. But now the ability to gather information is a million times more manifest.
Back then, an analyst usually was separate from a collection agent. The agent went out into the street. He was a gumshoe. Today, an analyst with a computer can amass enormous amounts of personal information, particularly since the Army has contracts with civilian corporations that collect personal information about licenses and license plates and addresses and relatives and friends. And they have one data bank the military has that nobody's focusing on much, is a data bank of all kids who are coming of age and might be potential military recruits. Well, they can go into that data bank and get all sorts of detailed information on a generation of young people, the entire nationwide generation of young people who might either be recruited or might protest the war. Either way, they have the information. It would be one thing if it was just information being buried within military intelligence. Serious, but not that big. Today we have military intelligence connected with 14 other federal agencies, including the FBI, the CIA, NSA, Homeland Security, connected also with 2,000 police departments, and state police units and state police fusion centers. Terrorism task forces, there are over 100 of those, of joint federal and state agency task forces. And numerous foreign countries with their intelligence and law enforcement agencies. They're all tied together by the fiber optic equivalent of the Great Alaska Pipeline. And enormous amounts of information, much of it erroneous, are flowing through this pipeline and going down into the computers of all these different agencies. So if Army intelligence picks something up about Quakers in Florida, it can end up in several thousand computers. And there are no procedures for correcting errors or for purging the files.
And is this Talon, is this what they're doing?
The Talon reports are the main one that was just disclosed in December. I've read those reports. I read 1,519 of them, and they really are part of a neighborhood watch system set up by the Air Force, very similar to the TIPS program that Attorney General Ashcroft wanted to create nationwide, but which conservatives in Congress shot down. And so the military's been doing it, and it's got a lot of garbage in it. For example, reports that military uniforms went missing at a dry cleaner's, that somebody mislaid some parking stickers for the base. But these are simply incidents, suspicious incidents. The incidents that are called threats are, without exception, anti-war protest activity.
Well,
those
this is
limited as threats.
This is where the rubber meets the road, though, isn't it? Is where, you know, if you start dividing this country between patriots and non-patriots, I mean, who makes these decisions of who's a patriotic American and who's not? I mean, isn't this completely subjective?
Well, I think that the people who run the system are not terribly sophisticated about what constitutes patriotism. They think patriotism is supporting the administration and supporting the military, and anybody who dissents is not a patriot. And, of course, that's silly. Some of the greatest patriots we've had in our history have been our dissenters, not our establishment types. But in any case, they classify these folks as threats to military security or national security. We had the same thing happen during World War I, World War II, and the Cold War. We create these fuzzy categories like threats or persons of interest or terrorist or subversive. And they have no real content to them. There are no real definitions and criteria. But they keep the agents happy. They keep full employment for the people who want to collect this sort of stuff. They give big briefings to the bosses, which really go nowhere. And the least creates the illusion that they're doing something to advance the nation's security.
So this
In fact,
just,
they're
this
not.
Is...
They're overloading the system with trivia and making it harder. But you see, these people don't know any Middle Eastern languages.
Right.
They really can have no impact on the intelligence operations against al-Qaeda. So they have to redefine the problem as domestic terrorism.
So it's really, you're talking about a system of welfare for paranoids because it doesn't do any good. But just in closing, it seems to me that the main suspicion that citizens should have about President of the United States circumventing FISA, creating the secret program, and now he's out running around the country trying to defend it as a wartime imperative. The bottom line is, this is a president whose entire political career has been elevated by sliming his opponents. So how could this man and his twin, Karl Rove, resist the enormous resources of the NSA not to find out what their political opponents are up to? I mean, it's to me, that's a temptation I can't imagine him resisting.
Well, I was on Nixon's enemies list, and I know that as these systems age, they move from simply collecting information to harassing people and trying to influence politics. And so your suspicion is well-founded.
I think
you don't have evidence yet of a Bush enemies list, but it would not surprise me, given the kind of hardball politics these folks play. And we know of how they have punished their people who have disagreed with them within the administration, so it wouldn't be too surprising if they were doing things outside that are more in the tradition of J. Edgar Hoover than of the Founding Fathers.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Christopher Pyle.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking today with Christopher Pyle, professor of politics at Mount Holyoke College. He was in Army intelligence during the Vietnam War, and he became the whistleblower that led to the Irvin Committee's investigations into domestic spying on American citizens. And we're talking about this in the context of the President of the United States unleashing the National Security Agency in secret upon American citizens. I'm now speaking with Eugene Jarocki, who's in the studio, acclaimed filmmaker, directed the documentary The Trials of Henry Kissinger. He has a new film, Why We Fight, inspired by President Eisenhower's fateful warning to America about the military-industrial complex in his farewell address. Obviously, Why We Fight comes from a Frank Capra World War II recruiting film.
Yes, it does.
Which was, everybody had to see that film, I believe, in World War II.
That's right. I mean, Frank Capra was asked during World War II to make a series of films really looking into and exploring America's reasons for going into that war. And people have said to me, why did you take Frank Capra's title? And I would go farther and say, I think I took his film. I really tried to make a Capra film. Capra was a great defender of democracy. He was a real steward of the little man, the little guy against great forces. You know, It's a Wonderful Life, George Bailey trying to protect his town essentially from Walmart, Jefferson Smith and Mr. Smith protecting that creek from special interests. And when Capra made the Why We Fight films, he took his desire to protect democracy and the little man global and said Americans had to stand up and fight for democracy. And I think my film is saying very much the same thing for different reasons.
But the difference is that in those days, after Pearl Harbor, the United States government commissioned Frank Capra to make this film.
Yes, they did.
President Bush has not commissioned anybody to make a film about why we fight in the war on terror. In fact, he himself has not been able to give a consistent story of why we even are fighting in Iraq. It used to be WMD, then it was bringing democracy, then it was securing oil, it was taking pressure off Israel, and now they're down to the old chestnut that we got rid of a bad guy.
I suppose you're actually on the kind of most central issue raised by my film, which is that the film looks at a number of American wars from World War II to today. And, you know, there are different reasons at all times for different wars. Some are geostrategic, some have military reasons, some have land reasons, resources. Those differ. What we found that unified American wars was that Iraq was not the first time that Americans have found out after a war has already gone too far, that the reasons they were given to begin with are not the actual reasons that were being discussed in behind closed doors. And so this phenomenon of, you know, the way in which the Gulf of Tonkin was as illusory as the WMDs in Iraq were, that's a phenomenon we see all too often in America, where there are lies and sort of deceptions at the outset of a war that lead us into that war. And so Mr. Bush's sort of flailing reason set is an example of this problem of why we fight. And when we went around America to about 30 states and asked everyday people on the street in the film on camera, you know, why do we fight? What are we fighting for? Almost everyone, to a man, the first word they said was freedom. And you had to ask yourself, actually, in a free country, what kind of situation do you have if everybody says the same exact answer to a complicated question? But so I wouldn't be satisfied with that. And I'd ask one more question. I'd say, well, what do you mean by that? What do you mean by freedom, for example? And right away, you would discover people's doubts. Right away, you would feel right beneath the surface that they had questions and concerns. We spoke to a child of 9 who knew the word Halliburton. I was amazed. We spoke to a middle-aged guy who said, I think we're fighting for freedom. At least I hope so. And that doubt was actually very inspiring to me, because Americans should have their good self-concept that America at one time and over its history has often fought on the side of the angels. But at the same time, one must look at this country with tough love. And that doubt that arises in the hearts of Americans from World War II to today, I think, is the beginnings of the kind of realism needed for tough love.
Well, let's face it, though, Eugene, everybody fights for their own righteous reasons. I mean, the bad guys are just as self-righteous in terms of and sure of so that's a moving target. But years ago, I made a film with Haskell Wexler called War Without Winners for Admiral LaRocque and the Center for Defense Information. And we dug up the the Eisenhower from the library and used it. And it's an interesting warning. Of course, his brother Milton, in the original draft of the speech, referred to it as the military-industrial congressional complex.
Well, it wasn't just Milton. It was Eisenhower himself who wrote that.
Right.
And at the 11th hour, you know, his son John is in the film and his granddaughter Susan, and they explain Eisenhower's thinking.
Right.
And it is an amazing thing. In the initial drafts, it was military-industrial congressional complex, because Eisenhower was deeply aware of the central role played by Congress in making possible the aspirations of the military and industrial elites, that without the participation of Congress, what we today call political engineering, and I can talk more about that, it's an amazing phenomenon in the defense industry, without sort of bringing members of Congress in on the deal and giving them a piece of the action, you couldn't see the money flow. And so we see that today, and that's part of what Eisenhower warned about that's come frightfully true. And the fact that he pulled the word congressional from the speech, although the film demonstrates that I have a great regard for Eisenhower and a great regard for his warning and for his evolution, that is an unfortunate loss, because I think the public – it would have been well served to hear the word congressional in that warning and be reminded that in the face of this growing influence, one could at least write one's congressman.
Well, in fact, his experience was with the Democrats, who were
absolutely
the ones that were in the pockets of the contractors, Symington and Henry Jackson, the senator from Boeing, who became the godfather to the neoconservatives.
Absolutely.
And you can make the argument that the neoconservatives that have brought us to Iraq – basically have been shills for the military-industrial complex, the Richard Pearls of this world, because there's never enough defense.
Well, I can tell you, I have an interesting, by getting really inside the world, both of the Pentagon and the defense industry and the think tanks, all of which we were very luckily able to penetrate at a very intimate level, I have a real understanding now of the anatomy of how the military-industrial complex interacts with the think tanks. And I do believe that Eisenhower warned about the think tanks when he went on after the military-industrial complex part of the warning to say that what happens if you build a military-industrial complex is that you create what he calls the disastrous rise of misplaced power. And that idea of a disastrous rise of misplaced power, misplaced means unelected, hiding in the shadows. Essentially, you build something so ready for action that it's a tempting tool for ideologues. And I think what we've seen in the recent war is a perfect dovetailing of where the interests of certain defense intellectuals lie and where the defense industry's interests lie. So, for example, you take a number of people who we've now heard too much about, Scooter Libby and others who apparently were running the business of this country, though none of us knew their names. And you think to yourself, well, none of these guys, if you look at their resume, have actually ever heard a shot fired in anger. Many of them are really just the sort of classic armchair general intellectual types. And they don't feel that comfortable talking about war with real soldiers and real men from the battlefield. So they feel awkward. They feel like intellectuals and nerds. And so they get into that situation, and suddenly they discover that coming out of the defense sector, which is hugely funded, as we know, are extremely polished, shiny, and sexy promotional videos and brochures and pamphlets talking about the high-tech precision weaponry that's going to make war and the blood and mud and boots of war a thing of the past. So all of a sudden, it gave these defense intellectuals, who otherwise didn't really have legitimacy to be talking about war, it gave them a kind of war that they were the perfect salesman for. It actually gave them a place to fit. And this is how you can see this disastrous rise of misplaced power that Eisenhower talked about take shape, because the military-industrial elites are trying to sell war to all of us as being more viable, more sustainable, more civilian-friendly. These are all myths, by the way, and we can talk about that. But it needed salespeople. And who are the salespeople that can sell high-tech stuff? That's what Eisenhower referred to in the speech as the scientific technological elite. And the scientific technological elite, he warned, could, quote, hold public policy captive, unquote, if we weren't careful. And I think that's sadly what we've seen.
I knew George Kistiakowsky, who is his science advisor, great man, one of the Manhattan Project people. And, of course, in contrast, President Bush didn't even want to have a science advisor, and it took us a long time. But, you know, again, he was in the context of Eisenhower's speech, you know, the Democrats were the ones that were pouring, you know, the pork out. And also, remember, Jack Kennedy was running against Nixon by trying to be further to the right than Nixon on defense and saying that our defenses were down. That was when he manufactured the missile gap. Of course, Eisenhower knew that it was bogus because he knew from the U-2 flights that there was no substance to it.
Yeah, his family told me that actually it was that very frustration he felt, that he knew because of the spy missions that we were, in fact, ahead of the Soviets. But he had to keep listening to the Kennedy team work him over about that and make him look soft on the Soviets that got him so frustrated. In fact, at one point, Eisenhower administration officials called in representatives of the Kennedy camp and literally took the risk of showing them the secret photos of the Soviet Union in order to get them to stop saying this missile gap nonsense. And it was a very cordial meeting. Everybody looked at the papers. The Kennedy people said, thank you very much. It's been very informative. Next day, they went back out on the campaign trail, reminding the public about the great missile gap that Ike had let come up between us and the Soviets.
So this serves as an example of why this is a winning issue. There's something in the DNA of this country that allows patriotism to be so manipulated. It's an extraordinary, because I mean, here we are, the United States of fear. We're terrified. You know, Bush the other day said, you know, we're at war. Bin Laden's going to strike us again. What is it about the world's lone superpower that makes it so afraid?
Well, I don't know that we're uniquely afraid as a country. What I think we are, and we're uniquely many things, and they usually come down to the size of America. Like, we make sandwiches bigger than everybody else. We make cars bigger. Our people seem to be getting bigger. Like, we just do everything in a more extreme fashion. And the number one thing I can tell you that I took away from this, on this question about how the American mind, is that after, and I, by the way, disagree with much of what the media tells us about the American mind, and I travel enormously in this country, and so I meet people in every small hand Hamlet you can imagine, and I'm never struck that what I'm getting is what I got on TV the night before. So for starters, I would say I'm not sure what people really think. I'm not sure what their fears really are. And the media not only tries to inspire fear, it also broadcasts that it has successfully inspired fear by telling us statistics about how fearful Americans are. It's a Orwellian reality that needs to be also dissected. But to step back from it, I would say this. When you look at America, you see that two things happened at the same time right after World War II. Capra and his gang successfully and quite beautifully galvanized an image of America for the troops that was a gang of motley, ne'er-do-well, sweet, well-meaning people who would beat these Axis monolithic superpowers not by being more powerful but by being more human, by being more
democratic.
More democratic. And that arsenal of democracy, that idea of America as America winning on the basis of her values is something that is really burned into the American psyche by Capra and by that moment in American lore. And so there comes that moment. But at the same time, we're really witnessing at that moment the birth of the mass media age. And in that mass media boom, we suddenly see that the American mind is the guinea pig for the first real experiment in mass media in human history. And I think we're all part of that. I don't think we have any idea, in the same way that somebody once didn't know that x-rays gave you cancer and 30 years later, tons of people were getting cancer. Roe versus Wade happened and 23 years later, there was a huge drop in crime. And people said, why is there a drop in crime? Well, because a lot of unwanted babies weren't born when Roe versus Wade happened, so it took 23 years for the cycle to reveal itself. We haven't had the cycle reveal itself of how the American mind has been affected and this kind of patriotism, this kind of nationalism, which Goebbels was good at as well, but Goebbels didn't have 24/7 news reporting to be able to contain every last waking minute of the American mind's wanderings.
Let me just again remind the audience, I'm speaking with Eugene Jarecki, who's in the studio with me. His new film is Why We Fight, borrowed from Frank Capra's classic World War II. I wouldn't call it a recruiting film, but a film that every person who entered the armed services saw. And this is a film about the current state of militarism in this country and the power or the consistent and growing power of the military-industrial complex. Of course, there is a new layer to this now. You said mentioned the 9-year-old boy who'd heard of Halliburton. We have double jeopardy now because not only do we have the traditional military-industrial complex who always had first grab at the treasury, there's a new layer that goes through through supplemental, so it's hardly ever voted on, and they just keep adding and adding money. I mean, so it's worth remembering that even though last week I had the economist on who came up with a figure that the war was going to cost us $2 trillion, that not only are Halliburton and others do they have a blank check, and presumably when the United States military pulls out of Iraq, the contractors will stay as long as they can. That's somewhat in doubt. But while
there's also no evidence that we're actually pulling out. I mean, we've built with those contractors' help, we've built 14 bases, so we're there permanently.
The evidence is that the insurgency is not going away. So, right. I mean, you can still basically keep an open mind and suggest perhaps that we're going to win that, lose that war. And I think that was a dynamic from the beginning that we were going to lose that one. But the long and the short of it is the country is still paying for ballistic missile defense. They're still paying for a bunch of destroyers. They're still paying for the F-22 and a couple of other planes, that fighters that we don't need. They're still paying for submarines that we're still building. So there's still this enormous machine that's going on. It's as though it's on autopilot.
Right. Well, I think there's two issues that have to be raised about the military-industrial complex. What Eisenhower was talking about was not a conspiracy theory. He was not a conspiracy theorist. He was a general. He was a hawk. He was a two-term Republican president and a very, very much a fiscal conservant. And I think what he was looking at was he has a great phrase in the farewell address where he talks about the need for balance in and among national programs. And I think what he's trying to say to us is that when a society decides in the name of security, chasing the bubble of perfect security, when it decides to start taking assets desperately needed by parts of the society, of your national life, from education to health to infrastructure, and taking resources away from those areas and diverting those resources disproportionately into simply the military expression of national power, what you end up with is a society that is tilted toward militarism and a society that indeed starts to see every problem as having a military solution. So that, for example, when you don't have proper money spent on infrastructure, a storm like Katrina rolls in, and the only people fit to deal with it is the guard. So you send those guys down.
Well, of course, the difference was that Eisenhower very cleverly built the highway system
out of
defense money.
And that's the key to it, because Eisenhower understood that national defense is about more than just bombs. It's best to say he understood that an uneducated population is undefended, can't run the machines of war, that an unhealthy population is unfit for war, and so forth. And what he mostly was saying is, if you have a country that lets the dogs of capitalism loose to chew up and erode the soul of our democracy, at the end of the day, what you will have is a populace that doesn't believe in Washington, doesn't believe in the country's mission, and they will not fight and die for the country. They won't care enough to do so. And so, in a certain way, even though what he's giving is a philosophic and moral argument, it's framed as an argument about national defense, and they dovetail beautifully.
I thank you so much for joining us in the studio, Yushin Chirekin.
Please tell people to come see the movie. It's being taken out all over the country by Sony, but it's all about people coming now to see it, because the way it makes a real noise in the country is if people come early. If they wait, distributors, they look at the movie, they go, we don't think anybody's interested. But if people are interested in this subject, I really urge people to come see it.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having
me. Again, Yushin Chirekin's new film, Why We Fight. And I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the engineer, Jazz Shepard, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, and this program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org.